Right now, there are over 150,000 people moving across national borders every year. Millions more remain uncounted because they are forced to remain undocumented. There are also hundreds of millions of people moving within the borders of national states, mostly from rural to urban sites. This level of migration is unprecedented in human history. We spoke with Nandita Sharma about Open the Borders, a group based in Vancouver, British Columbia, about immigration in the context of the war abroad through the American-led war on terrorism and the war at home here in Canada, led through the racist immigration policies such as the new, quote, Immigration Protection Act, Bill C-11.
Open the Borders has been around for a couple of years, and we largely were formed out of the experiences of a group of us that had worked with the women who had arrived on four separate boats from China to the west coast of British Columbia in the summer of 1999. And we found that most of the responses to the women, even by other advocates, were not actually meeting the needs of the women themselves, right? So, for example, we found that a lot of the advocates were arguing for a fair refugee hearing for these women without taking into account, for example, that the definition of refugee is so narrowly defined by both the United Nations and the Canadian government so as to completely exclude the experiences of these particular women who had come from China. So, you know, a call simply for fair refugee hearings was not going to do very much for these particular women, and that we needed a much more radical approach, which was to say that no one, coming out of the Sans Papier movement in France, that no one is illegal, that we need to be working towards a world where, you know, the lived experiences of people is what is valued and not the categories that nation states put up, and that, in fact, those categories like refugee or immigrant or illegal or citizen are all categories that divide people from one another and actually further, the processes of what we've been calling globalization. So Open the Borders really formed as saying, you know, it's time in Canada, and in North America that we arrive at a much more radical direction in terms of what we're demanding in regards to responding to international migration pressures. And the other thing was is that we wanted to make sure that Indigenous peoples were not left out of the movement, to make sure that no one is illegal, that we wanted to ensure that we recognized that Indigenous peoples had also been displaced, just like the migrants who we were advocating for, and that the displacement of both Indigenous people and, you know, the hundreds of millions of people displaced around the world are rooted in the same systems, right? Rooted in capitalism, rooted in racism, et cetera. So Open the Borders tried very hard to ensure that we dealt with both displacement issues as well as migration issues.
And there has been a lot of recent changes to Canada's immigration law, which is worsening these realities for a lot of people, for migrants, for immigrant and refugee communities. You mentioned there's hundreds of millions of people around the world that are undocumented, that are deemed illegal by national governments, 150 million people. So how do you feel that, I mean, these new laws in Canada, Bill C-11, the just-signed Safe Third Country Agreement, will relate to this crisis globally?
Well, ultimately what we need to recognize is that restrictive immigration policies like the new Immigration Act that we're now dealing with in Canada and the Safe Third Country Agreement with the United States are not only designed to stop the movement of people. We need to recognize that what they actually accomplish, right, is to make the majority of people who are moving, because you cannot stop the movement of people. I mean, the forces that are causing people to move are ultimately life and death issues, and, you know, you can't actually, no government in the world actually believes that it can stop the movement of people, and I don't believe that they intend to stop the movement of people. What the goal is of restrictive immigration policies like the new Canadian one is to deny status to most of the people who end up in Canada, and I think that's what the Safe Third Country Agreement is ultimately going to end up doing, is that people fleeing, most particularly from Central and South America, will continue to move. It's just that once they get into Canada, they will have no legal avenue for any kind of status in this country. And that, ultimately, is part and parcel of the, you know, processes of globalization, that making people vulnerable, making them illegal within, you know, the boundaries of any nation state, is very much a part of immigration policies. And it's a part of immigration policies because that makes people very vulnerable to employers, to landlords, to cops, you know, and so on.
Could you break that down a little bit more? In which ways are these people going to be more vulnerable than they already are?
Well, I mean, if you have no status, if Canada, like with the Safe Third Country Agreement, what Canada is going to accomplish by signing the Safe Third Country Agreement with Canada is, I mean, with the United States, is to be able to legally opt out from giving any refugee hearings to people coming in from, in particular, Latin America, right, which is where most of the people who travel by land through the U.S. to get to Canada are arriving from. So, you know, as I had mentioned, I don't believe that the Safe Third Country Agreement is actually going to stop the movement of people, but what it will do is that people who will, you know, somehow make it into Canada will have no legal recourse to apply for refugee status or any kind of immigration status. That was made illegal a long time ago, that you can't apply for immigration status from within Canada. So what they will end up being is undocumented peoples, you know, unable to access any social programs, unable to access any minimum labor standards protections, any minimum wage standards, any overtime protection, you know, unable to negotiate with landlords who can turn them in, unable to respond to police abuse, you know, incredibly vulnerable people. And that is something that I think the state is very, very aware of, that is going to be the consequence of its new immigration policy.
And often these people are scapegoated by mainstream society, by corporate media, by politicians, because of the situations they're in. You know, oftentimes it is difficult to find certain necessities in life. As you mentioned, it's hard to deal with landlords, employers, government policies. So often these people are scapegoated and really are made out to be criminals.
Well, I mean, I think that the other thing that we need to recognize when we're, you know, trying to formulate effective strategies around migration is that the scapegoating of people who are left incredibly vulnerable within any society is absolutely essential to the operation of the systems of power that we're trying to, you know, challenge. That it is absolutely essential that, you know, those people in Canada who consider themselves citizens, right, and consider themselves as belonging to Canada and consider their identity as very much wrapped up in being Canadian, that it is very essential for those people to continue to see the state as protecting them, right? That, and the way that the state has, you know, in the last 20 years, and, you know, obviously much longer than that historically, the way that the Canadian state has really propped itself up is in you know, putting forward various groups of people who it is persecuting, whether it's Indigenous peoples, whether it's people of color from the global south, as the enemies of the nation. And I think that that's a really essential component to globalization right now. You know, nationalism is not at all in any opposition to processes of globalization, and in fact, they're absolutely essential to them. It's absolutely essential that people in Canada see the problem as always one of foreigners, right, and outsiders. And the way that we counter that, I think the kind of the open the borders, no one is illegal kind of strategies are possibly the most important way to counter that, to say that, look, you know, the necessities of life should not be determined by the nation state. The nation state should not have the power to determine the movement of people and who gets protections and who doesn't get protections, who gets food and who doesn't get food. That should be determined by people and not by nation states or employers, for example. So I think that the Open the Borders kind of program is one way that we can really challenge it, because ultimately we're challenging the authority of the nation state over the people who reside within this territory called Canada, and ultimately we're challenging the very existence of something called Canada anyways, which is, you know, based on stolen land of Indigenous peoples.
Mm-hmm. Could you speak about that a little bit, how the struggle for self-determination of Indigenous peoples in Canada, how you feel that relates to the struggle against borders globally?
Well, both Indigenous peoples and people who are, you know, made to be illegal have both experienced, you know, serious processes of displacement, right? Both of them have been affected by the imposition of national boundaries. You know, for Indigenous peoples, obviously, the national boundaries that they have to contend with are, you know, based on their subjugation, right? That Indigenous peoples in what we now call Canada or the U.S., you know, are the peoples and their lands that these two nation states are based on. And nation states have taken upon themselves the power to determine who gets to be a member of that society and who doesn't get to be a member, who gets to be called illegal. So we think that, you know, at Open the Borders, as I was mentioning earlier, we've tried to make very, very concrete connections between Indigenous struggles for self-determination and land and migrant struggles for, you know, dignity and a livelihood and all that kind of stuff. And I think that they are really related, because in both instances, it's national states and the larger system of capitalism that nation states prop up that are ultimately destroying the self-determinacy of both Indigenous peoples and the peoples who are, you know, forced to come here.
And in many ways, the new immigration policies and some of the actions that have been taken by the Canadian state and the American state post September 11th, the lockup of thousands and thousands of people from the Middle East and South Asia, the new immigration policies are, you know, really criminalizing these people and putting bars in front of people's lives.
And terrorizing entire communities, right, which I think is the ultimate intent of disappearing the thousands of people that you've spoken about, you know, like... You know, when you talk to people within the South Asian communities, within, you know, Arab communities, within any communities of color, there is an incredible terror now that the state and the police forces and the armies can act with absolute impunity upon their bodies, upon their, you know, homes, upon their, you know, entire lives. And I think that that is definitely one of the major intentions of the you know, both the Canadian and the U.S. governments going after, you know, people with their, you know, racial profiling practices.
There was an article today in the Globe and Mail where a Muslim man was speaking about the fear that he experiences every day when he goes to pray. After September 11th, a mosque in St. Catherine, Ontario, was burnt down. So I guess in many ways, this is a reality that people are living. This is a constant fear. So, and to add to this, the Safe Third Country Agreement has been signed. C-11 is coming into practice. Could you break down the Safe Third Country Agreement? What does it mean specifically in terms of law?
Well, the Safe Third Country Agreement is becoming kind of like the universal way that nation states are bypassing their commitments to the United Nations Convention Refugee Policy, which meant that if a person... You know, the convention refugee definition was that if a person was fleeing persecution on the basis of various things, that a country was obligated to hear that person's claim and, if successful, to give that person equal status with citizens within the nation state. So around the world, like the European Union has signed Safe Third Country agreements with all of its bordering countries. Canada, as you mentioned, just signed one at the end of June with the United States. And what that effectively means is that any person who had to travel through the United States before they could come to Canada to make their refugee claim will be automatically sent back to the United States, where they will be told, which they've been told is a safe country, hence the safe third country term. Refugee claimants who come to Canada through the U.S. will be told, go back to the United States. They'll be deported back to the United States by the Canadian government, and the U.S. will be the country that is supposedly going to hear their refugee claim. But as we know, historically, the United States refugee process is the most politicized refugee process in the entire world, that the United States has historically refused to recognize refugees from any country whose dictatorship they're supporting, for example, which would include most of Central and South America, most of the world at this point. So basically what the Safe Third Country Agreement means is that Canada now has a legal loophole to deny hearing anyone's refugee claims if they've traveled to the U.S., which most people coming through Central and South America have to do, because very, very few refugee claimants in the world have the kind of money or the resources to just hop a plane directly into Toronto or directly into Montreal or Vancouver. They have to go through the United States. And what this even means is that if your plane landed in the United States, you know, as a stopover, you will no longer be able to make a refugee claim in Canada. So, I mean, it is a very, very shifty way for the Canadian government to, you know, bypass all of its responsibility to the UN Convention.
And what kind of rhetoric is Immigration Canada backing this up with?
Well, they're saying that, you know, all of these people who are claiming refugee status are just kind of asylum shopping, is the one that we hear often, that why don't they just stay in the United States and apply for refugee status there? Why do they move on up to Canada and apply here? Well, the reason for it is because the United States hardly accepts any refugees, you know, especially from Central and South America, and in this era, from any country in the world whose dictatorships they're supporting, whose governments they're supporting. So, you know, for people traveling to the United States to Canada, they have a very good reason not to apply for refugee status in the United States. But Canada is supporting the myth of the United States as a somehow objective, democratic force that will somehow fairly hear these people's claims.
And could you speak about some of the resistance that is occurring specifically to these laws, but also against borders? I mean, the resistance that is happening all over the world, Strasbourg, France, and also the work that you do on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I mean, I am just totally amazed at how many No Borders networks are now being organized around the world, how many organizations are now using the banner of No One is Illegal, how many groups are radicalizing their demands regarding immigration practices. And, you know, as you mentioned, there was a conference in Strasbourg this last week where No Borders types activists from around the world were kind of gathering to figure out a strategy that's transnational, like how do we work with each other across borders in the hope of ultimately dismantling them. The work that we do at Open the Borders is largely about trying to mainstream the very radical idea that borders should not exist, that nation-states are part of the problem, that national boundaries contain people. They don't liberate us. They don't provide us with a community. They don't give people homes, particularly if they're people of color and indigenous peoples, that, you know, part of the struggle against capitalist globalization has to include the struggle against nation states, because they're part of the same system. So the work that we do, for example, we do direct work with people who are experiencing problems with Canadian immigration. So we, you know, try and be relevant to people's lives, because that's the only way that you build an effective movement, is that if you're actually working with people who are experiencing the, you know, repression firsthand. We also work very closely with indigenous communities that are trying to prevent their own displacement. So in British Columbia, some members of Open the Borders are working with the protection program for the people, indigenous people who are opposing Sun Peaks Resort development, which is a ski resort in the mountains in British Columbia. And ultimately what we're doing is really trying to radicalize the kind of immigrant rights discourse, so that we're no longer just calling for fair immigration policies, that we're recognizing the inherent unfairness of these policies, and that we're actually calling for the right for people to determine when and if they move, not the right of states to determine that.
You can find out more info about Open the Borders at www.opentheborders.org. Also visit www.noborder.org for more information pertaining to these struggles.